You are listening to the Passion City Church podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart. It's a continuation of a series entitled Worthy.
Well, when I was mid-20s, I remember my mom called and said, hey, I want to get you, your brother and sister, the family, to go to Colorado on vacation. My brother was living in Colorado at the time. She said, I want to take you to this resort. Y'all are going to have a blast. Let's all do this as a family. So we flew up to my brother's place, all threw our bags into his trunk of his car, jumped into his car. We drove up to this little resort, and we're like, let's have family fun for a few days up in Colorado. And I remember as we were getting our stuff out of the car, walking towards this hotel, my mom stopped me at one point in the parking lot, and she said, Ben, is that your underwear on the ground? And I said, yes. It's odd. And so I just picked it up and just kind of put it away and walked into the hotel. And as we were checking in, suddenly the bottom of my bag flipped open like a lid and all the contents fell out in the lobby. And I'm like, whoa, what a cheap bag. So I just kind of had to like gather all my things in my arms, which is a little weird when you're walking through a hotel when you're like, I hate bags, right? I'm anti-luggage. And just carried my things to the hotel room. But we were going out for dinner that night, so I was excited, undaunted, so we're all getting ready, and it turns out my brother forgot pants. So he's like, can I borrow some of your pants? I'm like, sure. I give him a pair of jeans, and we're walking around in Colorado, and I look over at one point, and there's a huge hole in the leg of the pants, and I'm like, dude, what did you do? And he's like, I don't know. I was like, what do you mean you don't know? I was like, I love those pants. I'm like, come on, man, because it wasn't a cool hole. It was weird, and I was just like, dang it, right? And then I remember later that next day, I was getting dressed, and while I was buttoning a shirt, just a chunk came out of the middle of the shirt, and I just kind of grabbed a fistful and was like, that's not right. And I remember at one point asking my brother, I was like, wait a second, man, something's wrong here. And I said, can we go back to your car? And so we went back to his car, and I remember we opened the trunk, and sure enough, there was an old car battery in the trunk of his car. And I was like, okay. I see. What had happened was battery acid was leaking out and had soaked my bag. And the way battery acid works, apparently, if you don't know this, is it doesn't just eat your clothes, it soaks into them and weakens every fiber. So over the next months, because I had way overpacked and brought everything I love, every time I got dressed, I put on a pair of socks and just like ripped the tops off. And arms are coming off my shirts. And I'm like, dang it. So I had to re-wardrobe. And you go, what happened? It's because something got in there and soaked every fiber and weakened it, right? And we found the weakness when tension came. Now, why mention that? Because the same thing happens to us socially, physically, spiritually, emotionally. We are subject to forces outside of us in the culture that affect us, soak into us, but often we don't even know. And we don't even know it's affecting us. What? Until the moment of Christ, something comes out and we go, wait a second, I've been weakened in this area. And we don't know unless we pop the hood and kind of look in and say, what is it that's affecting me? And I want to talk about something that's affecting our mindset. And particularly, it's something that's often laid at the feet of millennials. And I mention that because it's interesting. It's official. Pew Research came out with it this week. There's an end cap now to millennials. Anyone born after 1996 is now something else, whatever you call them. It's up to debate what we're going to call those kids, right? Gen Z's out there, post-millennial, which just means after the one we came up with a name for. So we don't know what we're going to call the kids in college. But if you were born between the ages of 1981 and 1996, ages 22 to 37, you are now in this group that we just love to study and all talk about. And the reason I bring you up is because we have an interesting fact about our city you probably know. More than one out of every three humans that live in Washington, D.C. are millennials. Did you know that? So we got any millennials in the room? Can I hear by a round of applause? Don't raise your hand, millennials. Any millennials in the room? Okay. That sounded like maybe a third, right? Maybe more. I don't know. So I want to talk about something. I want to talk about narcissism. Because it's something that gets put at your doorstep that's affecting you, right? Oh man, Facebook, so narcissistic. Instagram, so narcissistic. These kids today, so narcissistic. They're always taking pictures of themselves. And people keep saying that about your generation. You're narcissistic people. And you go, well, what does that even mean? Well, I'm not going to get into all the history, ancient myth, first century BC. Narcissus fell in love with his reflection. But what it came to mean over time is what? A preoccupation with self and a diminishing empathy for the other. And you go, that is soaking our culture, right? Now, is it a purely millennial problem? I don't know, man, but there's evidence that it's in the culture everywhere. You see it in songs. This was interesting. I read a report done by Gene Twenge and Keith Campbell, and they did a research of the last three decades of hit songs, and they found a statistically significant trend towards narcissism and hostility in popular music. Movements away from words like we and words like us and towards words like I and me. A decline in words about social connection and positive emotion. I want to hold your hand. And an increase in words about anger and antisocial behavior like hate and kill, right? And so according to their research, what they would say is the incidences of narcissistic personality disorder have more than doubled in the U.S. over the last 10 years. And people normally put it at your feet. And so you go, well, that's interesting. Are you more narcissistic? Well, for some people you go, some of the way we study it is a little weird. Like the NPI, which studies narcissism, if you answer yes to the statement, I'm a leader, you get 1 point as a narcissist. And I'm like, really? So some of this, I'm like, okay, let's be careful, right? Other thing I wanna say is this too. I always think it's funny when you just kind of couple out one generation, and it's usually the older generation that assesses them, and you go, okay, that's fine, but if it's in a completely disconnected way, you're like, that's not how life works. We're all connected. You know what I mean? Like, I remember when Gen X was coming out, they're like, oh, they're all so bitter, and they're all so angry, which was kind of true. It was a lot of grunge, a lot of aggression in the 90s, but you go, that's not disconnected from the 80s. Which was the me generation. I do whatever's good for me, whatever makes me happy. And then you had a generation of upset, hurt kids because parents believed the lie that if I'm happy, then the kids are happy, so I do whatever I want. And then you had a bunch of angry kids and they're like, well, these kids today are angry. And you're like, you raised them, right? And so then we had a movement of, well, let's take care of kids. And let's tell them they're amazing. Let's tell them they're awesome. Let's think they can be whatever they can be. And let's tell them they're incredible. And let's tell them they can shoot to the moon and they can do all this crazy stuff. And now we're like, I don't know, these kids are kind of full of themselves. And you're like, you raised them. So we're all connected. So are you self-absorbed and entitled? Yes, but not uniquely so. I think our whole culture is experiencing some of that. And here's the reality. In the 80s, it was all about money. You know, now it's all about fame primarily and power, where we search for things, right, to make us feel good about us. And what's unique that you're experiencing, we are experiencing as a culture now, is the democratization of celebrity. Now I'm a brand that I can curate, and fame is a way to just sort of make myself valuable, right? And you go, well, that's a unique challenge for your generation. Would previous generations have done such a thing as taken photos of themselves? Well, in the 1800s, Robert Cornelius did. This is from the Library of Congress, widely believed to be the first selfie taken while standing in the yard of his family lamp store in Philadelphia. Snapped the photo, snap being a relative term because historians say it took him anywhere between 3 and 15 minutes of standing completely still to get that picture based on how much light was in the backyard. So you go, would people have back in the 1800s taken a bunch of selfies? Well, sure they did, but that took 15 minutes. And back then, no one had that kind of time. The goats aren't gonna milk themselves. And so they just didn't have the tech, right? Now we have the technology, and what do we find out? Humanity has always struggled with wanting things for us. And there's a million ways, as Martin Luther said, for a drunk to fall off a horse, right? There's only one way to sit upright. And so what do I want to look at is, man, we're all falling off the horse in different ways. And celebrity culture, wanting to be popular, wanting to be noticed, wanting it to be about me is not new. There's some new flavors to it now with your generation, and some new challenges with technology that aren't your fault, but are your problem. So the question is, how do we handle this? And how I want to answer it is I want to go back and say the challenges we're facing are not new. Celebrity culture is not new. And I'm not against someone becoming famous. I think there's danger in the pursuit of it, though. And so I want to talk about some of that by looking at the first celebrity in the Bible and see the path he took, and then by the grace of God, see another path, right? And so that's why we went to Genesis chapter 10 and read this genealogy of Rama and Sheba and Dedan and Gary and Keith, and on it goes forever, the part most of you skip, but then something weird happens in the middle. One guy gets three verses of explanation. Did you notice that? Because nobody else does. Everyone else, you get a name and you're done, right? And so that's why you never read them unless you're looking for baby names and you're like, I don't think I'm gonna name my kid Sheba, right? Maybe you did, I don't know. If you did, I would love to meet Sheba or Rama or Dedan, but we stop on Nimrod, and we learn a couple things about him, right? Number one, we learn is he's powerful. You saw in verse 8, now Cush became the father of Nimrod, and he became like a mighty one on the earth. Giborim, the strong one, champion, tyrant, hoss. That's how you can translate that word. His is the power. He's a powerful man. And then the next thing you find out in verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Now, they didn't have football back then. They didn't have mixed martial arts. They didn't have different ways to sort of express your dominance physically in sports, but they had hunting, which was a relatively new development. Biblically speaking, it's only a chapter old, right? And so here, there's this new phenomena of hunting, and he's good at it. He excels at the activity that's valued in the day. That's the point. Do you see it? He's the star running back of Babylon U, right? And that skill set made him famous. And you go, well, how do you know if he's famous? If there's no Twitter or Instagram, how do you know? Well, you look in verse 9. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. He's so famous, he's proverbial, right? That when people want to express he's good, you say his name, and we do this kind of stuff now. Like, you don't just say someone's rich. You say, man, that guy's like Bezos rich or something like that. That guy's like Bill Gates rich, something like that. You see what I'm saying? Or if someone's playing basketball, you're like, man, you're like LeBron. You just say that because it communicates you're as good as this guy. That's what they were doing back then. If someone did something good, they'd be like, dude, that was like Nimrod good, all right? Like, you are like a Nimrod, man. And it was awesome to be a Nimrod, right? He's known, he's valued, he's recognized. It's not just that people are singing his songs, people are singing the songs about him. His is the glory, right? And he's in charge. That's what you find out in verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel in the land of Shinar. His is the kingdom, that's who he is. I'm powerful, I'm famous, I'm in charge. His is the power, his is the glory, his is the kingdom. Right? And the world will follow him, right? The beginning of his kingdom was Babel in the land of Shinar. Now, chapter 10 keeps going on in genealogies. And then verse 11, it stops and tells a story. And what story does it tell? The building of Babylon in the plain of Shinar, right? So it stops the story to tell, or it stops the genealogy to tell the story of what Nimrod built. And so most commentators say, this is Nimrod leading the charge on this. And another way you know is because God will see what they're about to build as a rebellious thing. And the name Nimrod means let us rebel. So what do you think? I think these are his people. He's leading this. And so you see in chapter 11, they begin to move. And in verse 4, they say, come, let us build for ourselves a city. Let's build a place about us. Let's build something for us. Let's carve out our place in the world. Ours is the kingdom. And a tower whose top will reach into the heavens. Towers are a statement of dominance and power. That's why we're still trying to build the tallest buildings in the world, right? Because it shows, like, look how powerful I am. Ours is the power, right? Into the heavens. Let's build into the very realms of the gods, right? We will rise. Ours is the power. And let us make a name for ourselves. Let's do it so we'll be somebody. Let's build this so everyone will know us. Let's build it so they'll sing about us. Ours is the kingdom. Ours is the power. Ours is the glory. Let's find worth in our achievements. Let's find a sense of significance in our celebrity that people know my name. But then they do something so interesting. Right before they're done talking, they tip their cards and they show you the motivation behind it all. They say, otherwise, we will be scattered abroad over the face of the earth. And I find that part so fascinating to me, because everything before that's so bold. Let's build a city. Let's build a tower to the heavens. They will know our names. And if we don't, we'll be nothing. We'll be nothing. But do you hear that? The root of all this energy is the fear of anonymity. It's the fear of being a nobody. It's the fear of not mattering. What's driving the use of their energy is not the benefit of humanity. It is a terror at being nobody. Right? See, that's the interesting thing about studying narcissism in your generation, in our culture today, is because there are some people who are narcissistic, believe they're awesome, and want you to believe they're awesome because they believe they're awesome. That's the classic narcissist. I want you to believe I'm awesome. Why? Because I am awesome. And I need you to know that, right? And they're among us, right? There's people like that. What you see a lot more of, though, is people who project, I want you to believe I'm awesome. Why? So that maybe I'll believe I'm awesome. And it doesn't come out of this solid belief of like, y'all should know this. To maybe if enough people know me, I'll feel good about me. Maybe if I get enough glory, I won't be scattered. Do you see that? Fear is driving a lot of what we do, what we say, and what we post. It's not about encouragement, not about life, not about us. It's about me. But it's not because you're self-absorbed, it's because we're hurting. Brené Brown said it this way, endearing greatly, when asked about narcissism in the young people, she said, I see the shame-based fear of being ordinary. I see the fear of never feeling extraordinary enough to be noticed, to be lovable, to belong, to cultivate a sense of purpose. I can see exactly how and why more people are wrestling with how to believe they're enough. I see the cultural messaging everywhere that says an ordinary life is a meaningless life. Kids that grow up on a steady diet of reality TV, celebrity culture, unsupervised social media can absorb this messaging and develop a completely skewed sense of the world. I am only as good as the number of likes I get on Facebook or Instagram. Or Lynn Twist said it this way in her book, The Soul of Money, where she calls the sense of being, quote, never enough as the great lie. She said, for me and for many of us, our first waking thought of the day is, I didn't get enough sleep. The next one is, I don't have enough time. Whether true or not, that thought of not enough occurs automatically before we even think to question or examine it. We spend most of the hours of our days, or of the days of our lives, hearing, explaining, complaining, or worrying about what we don't have enough of. Before we sit up in bed, before our feet touch the floor, we're already inadequate, behind, already losing, already lacking something. By the time we go to bed at night, our minds are racing with a litany of what we didn't get or didn't get done that day. We go to sleep burdened by the thoughts and wake up to the reveille of lack. This internal condition of scarcity, this mindset of scarcity, lives at the very heart of our jealousies, our greeds, our prejudices, and our arguments with life. And I would say what we do is say, we got to build, lest we be scattered. I got to build my kingdom for my power, for my glory, so that maybe I'll feel glorious, feel like I matter. There's fear at the base of it. Madonna just turned 60. And still going for it. I'm not really maybe watching all her stuff, but I just saw when she turned 60, like, man, she's still out there working it. Sold over 300 million records, recognized as the best-selling female recording artist of all time, has the highest grossing solo touring artist of all time, has earned $1.3 billion from her concerts. Still touring at 60. And here's what she wrote. I have an iron will. And all of my will has been to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being. Then I go to another stage where I'm mediocre and uninteresting again and again. My drive in life is from a horrible fear of being mediocre. And that's always pushing me. Because even though I've become somebody, I still have to prove I am somebody. My struggle has never ended, and it probably never will. Can you believe that? Look at the line of young pop stars that want even a fraction of her success. But she's standing up there saying, it's a constant fear driving me that I'm gonna be nobody. Does that sound like freedom? No, but it sounds like a lot of us, doesn't it? And it sounds like these guys. And that's the problem. When fear becomes your motivator of why you build, it'll drive you the wrong direction in life. You see it in verse 1. It says, the whole earth used the same language and same words, and it came about that they journeyed east to the plain of Shinar. It's interesting, in the book of Genesis, going east is always a sign of trouble. And it doesn't have the connotations of west and east and people groups that we use now. Back then, it was when Adam and Eve rebelled against God, they go east. After Cain kills his brother, he goes east. And so when chapter 11 starts and it says, and these people decide to go east. As you're reading the story, as soon as you hear that, you're like, uh-oh. You're going the wrong way, y'all. That your fear motivation is gonna lead you down paths you were never meant to go. When you let fear drive that chasing, you're gonna head the wrong direction. I remember for me, when I was in college, the pinnacle of success was if you got an interview with Enron. Some of you already know where I'm going with this. Back then, what we knew was you were somebody if they wanted you. Because Enron was the biggest company on the block. Enron was the most successful company on the block. Enron was crushing. Forbes named them the most innovative company in America for 6 consecutive years. Even if you didn't get hired, if they just looked at you, you would see it in people when they walked down the hall, like suddenly they'd get a limp. They're like, yeah, I just got back from an interview with Enron. You know, like suddenly they're somebody because Enron sees me, right? And then what happened? We found out to stay on top, they were, you know, committing fraud and stuff. Right? Shady accounting practices, right? That tanked the whole company overnight. It's fascinating. This is a side story, but I was a youth pastor at the time. So my friends who were working there, big cars, big money, big deals. And I was literally, I had a broom closet from my office. So I'd literally just be like, I'm gonna move this broom out of the way and I can just kind of snuggle in right here and work with my youth group of 6 kids. And then I upgraded to like a real office. And some guy was like, hey man, you should go down to this warehouse and get furniture. And I went to this warehouse and there was these gorgeous solid wood desks stacked 6 high in this endless warehouse. It looked like the warehouse at the end of Indiana Jones. I don't know if you ever saw that where you're just like, I can't see the end of the room. And I asked him, what's all this furniture? And the guy's like, Enron. He said, they just had to walk away. He said, I paid $10,000 and got every stick of furniture in that building. He's like, you want a desk? Take whatever desk you want. He's like, you want a credenza? I'm like, I don't even know what that means, you know? But I'll take 2. And I just had a ridiculous amount of furniture and a ridiculous quality of furniture. People would walk into my room and just be like, what is this? And you're like, plundered the Egyptians, man. Pays to be a youth pastor in these cities. Now, their fear of being nobody drives them the wrong direction. Drives them to start making compromising decisions. And some of you that way. I don't care if you go online, but some of you, the reason why you're going, you're starting to try to develop an image online that's not healthy for you. It's not taking you the right direction. Some of you, the way you handle money, you're trying to get to a level, and so you're willing to compromise in some of your decision making. And you don't even see it, but you're starting to go the wrong way. You're going east, right? Not only do they go the wrong direction, they build something unstable. Verse 3, they say to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they used bricks for stones, and they used bitumen for mortar. And I know some of you, when you read that, you're like, there's the Bible being weird again. Like, why describe that it's bitumen? Like, I even know what that means. But you got to remember, who was the original audience of this? The nation of Israel, just freed from Egypt. They'd been doing what? Making bricks for 400 years. So you include some brick detail, right? That gets them. They're like, oh, bricks, I like this part. And I guarantee you, they would have cracked up laughing at this part. They would have been like, they did what? Bitumen. And Moses is like, all right, guys. Because stone is more solid than man-made bricks that you make with mud and straw, right? And the tar they're using is not near as solid as what you would make with a better mortar. And so what they're laughing at is these guys are trying to reach the heavens, but what they're building isn't steady. It isn't solid, right? And for you, when you're trying to build a sense of self-worth, my concern is for many of us, you're doing good things. I don't mind if you become, if you get a raise, if you get elevated at your company, if you become the president, if you become a celebrity, if you have millions of people follow you online, I think all that's fine. What I'm concerned about is the why behind the decisions you make. And if you're trying to build your sense of self on all that, that stuff can go away overnight. And if you don't know that, think back to high school. I saw it as a college minister. Every fall semester, you know, college, they just went back like this week, all these colleges heading back. I remember there was always that guy that wore his high school letter jacket to college. And you're like, man. You're like, bro. You know, you could tell though, you're like, he built his empire in high school. High school's where he peaked. He was like, I was in the glee club. I was in track, basketball, football, three-peater. I'd done it all. It's right here on the B on my chest. I got all the little logos. They had to put extra logos on the back. There's my name, and there's the nickname no one called me, but I liked that nickname. And so here's this part, and they would wear that. And you'd see them by the end of high school, they were just standing upon the mountain of all their fame and their achievements, and they're like, I have arrived. And then they show up to college in that same letter jacket. And nobody cares, man. Nobody cares. And I remember having to counsel people that you go, you know, all that stuff was great that you did. It's awesome. But if you were building your sense of identity on that, it's over now. And these people are trying to build their identity on some things that fade. Lee Iacocca said it, straight talk. He said, I'm in the twilight years of my life, still wondering what life's about. But I can tell you this, fame and fortune's for the birds. That's a colloquialism, young people, which means it's not really worth anything. Fame and fortunes for the birds. I remember I had a friend in my 20s that, I mean, he was a social rock star. I mean, he was the guy that walked in the room and everybody knew him, you know? And he was just like big man on campus, like wherever you were. He just knew people. He's one of those guys that if you go somewhere with him, you got to leave extra time because everyone knows him. You know what I mean? Like you go to a concert, and you're like, all right, hang on. Because he's over there like, what's up, man? I know that. And like he knows everybody and you're like, all right. And he was just the life of the party. So I remember there was one time we were in Austin together and we were at this bar and I was designated driving. And I mentioned that because I was always the guy that was super bored. When you'd go to a bar in Austin, it'd be like 2 a.m. and everyone's like laughing, telling stories. And I'm like, are we almost done, guys? Because I got to drive y'all back 2 hours. And this is hateful. And for the first time, he was sitting by himself too, which was weird. I'm like, that's kind of my thing. And he's over there by himself. And so I walk over to talk to him. And I'm like, how are you doing, man? And I remember he just looked up at me and he was like, man, he said, I work so hard to try to make people like me. I was like, what are you saying? Like, everybody loves you. And he was like, I'm constantly trying to make sure everybody likes me because I don't like myself very much. He said, and I'm so tired and I'm sick of it and I hate it. And it's so weird for me because I was like, this dude looks like he's got it all. This guy is a tower to the heavens, but it's a hollow tower. He built this popularity that he's like, you know what? It's not stable. It can't support the weight of my identity. It can't. Celebrity can't. And he's feeling that. It fades. And whatever you're building your sense of worth on, be careful if it's something transient. If it's your looks, looks will fade. If it's your career, careers change. Be careful what you build your worth upon. Is it bricks? Is it bitumen? That's trouble. And so in the end, it leads to confusion. It says here at the end, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the sons of men had built. There's irony in there. They were building their tower up to the heavens, and it says the Lord came down to see what they built. It doesn't mean like the Lord walked down some stairs. The idea is that we think we're rising up and what we're doing is so important, and God's like looking down, like when you're in an airplane, you're like, are those cars? Is that a building? God's like, what are they doing? And then God says, they're all together. If we let them do this, anything's possible for them. That is not the statement of a rival's jealousy. It's a parental concern, right? That's not God going, oh no, if we don't stop them, they might actually get here. That's God going, if we don't stop them, they are capable of anything. I have three children and I do this all the time, you know? You know when they're up to something because they fall silent. You know, normally it's screaming and pandemonium in our house. And then when you hear them fall silent, you're like, wait a second. And then normally I creep up the stairs, open the door, and you see it. Like, as soon as you open the door, they like stash the plans under the rug and like hide the tools and implements. And they're like, whoa, we weren't doing anything. And you're like, okay. Planning their little jailbreaks. But there are times where you go, you know what? For their own good, I gotta break this party up. You go to that room, you go to that room, you, I don't know, go run circles over there and get away from each other. Because if I keep it all together, there's no telling what you might light on fire. And so God, in verse 7, says, come, let us go down there and confuse their language. In verse 8, so the Lord scattered them abroad from the face of the earth and stopped their building. God in his mercy will scatter them. And for many of us, he'll do that to you. Some of you, he'll do it by not giving you what you want. Some of you, you want a thing so bad. And some of you have a bitterness towards God because he won't give you that thing. That relationship, that promotion, that recognition, that thing, he won't give it to you. And you're mad at him about it. But he's doing it because he knows that thing will never satisfy. You want it for the wrong reasons. You don't want to be a leader so you can lead us well. You don't want to have a platform so you can say things that help us. You want a platform to make you feel good about you. You want to lead us to feel good about you. And that's not good for us and it's not good for you, right? So God in his mercy will keep from you what you want. For me in high school, I wanted success at football. That was my high school version of it. And it wasn't so much about playing the game. It was about my dad thinking I was worthwhile. And when my femur broke, that was over. And that was something God and I had to deal with. God scattered me, right? And some of you, he'll do that to you. Others of you, which is scarier, is he'll give you everything you want and it won't satisfy. And you'll be Jay-Z writing Holy Grail, where he talks about how he got it all. And the best he can come up with at the end is, you're still alive. You'll still survive. And you go, that's it, man? That's it? You're talking about, at least I'm still alive? Jack Higgins was a novelist. His breakout novel sold 50 million copies. Every one of his novels after that was an international bestseller, translated in over 50 languages. And when he was asked, what do you wish you knew when you were young? He said that when you get to the top, there's nothing there. Right? Gene Twenge's book was entitled, Why Young Americans Are More Confident, Assertive, Entitled, and Miserable Than Ever. Why? Because we can build our tower to the heavens, but it won't satisfy the human heart. And that's the beauty of the genealogy. Why do we even read that? I won't get back into it, but in Genesis chapter 10, another guy gets a sentence named Peleg. It's another name to cross off your baby list. You know, that's the only reason you read them anyway, right? Genealogies? Peleg? No. But it says his name's Peleg because in his day, the world was divided. And I remember when I was a kid, someone teaching that, they're like, that's because the world was all connected in a panacea and the tectonic plates shifted and then we became the countries. And you're like, wait, what? No, read the genealogy, man. You see, Peleg is divided. And you see this genealogy go one way all the way down to Nimrod. And he builds a tower that gets him nowhere. And he's scattered. And then the genealogy starts over again with the same names. Shem, Ruah, you're like, I already know this. We already know this. And then it gets to Peleg, and it goes the other way. And you follow a different set of people down a different path, and you end in Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, where the Lord says to Abram, leave your country. Leave your relatives. Leave your father's house. Those were all the places where you would find your sense of identity. He says, leave the security of your money. Leave the fame of being known in your tribe. Go to the land I will show you. God makes him go west. He says, and I will make you a great nation. Notice that. For the people of Babylon, it was, let us build. Let us, let us, let us. The repetition of let us. Down the other path, it's, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. So you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. The one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Did you see that? God picked seven statements, number of perfection, to tell Abraham, I don't want you to build out of fear. I want you to walk by faith. And when you trust me, it's not gonna be, let me do this so I won't be scattered. It's you walk with me and I will take care of you. I will bless you. I will make your name great. Abraham's going to be famous. He's been on the cover of Time magazine multiple times. No one's going to name their kid Nimrod. There's some Abrahams out there, right? Name your dog Nimrod. Sorry. But notice why God does it. I will bless you. I will make your name great. Why? I will bless you so you will be a blessing. And so every family on the earth will get blessed through you, right? God's okay with making you a leader. Abraham's gonna lead hundreds of men and women. God's okay with you being famous. Abraham is gonna have kings kneel at his feet. But do you see what he did? He's not building for his glory. He's taking a walk for God's. And when he lands in Canaan, which Canaan's not Bible land, little gated community with just his fellow Christians that they all just get together and have Christian discussions about Christian things. God takes him to the land of Canaan, land of Canaan, land of Canaan, under the oaks of Moreh, where they're worshiping pagan gods. God leads his people into trouble, not out of trouble, into the world, not out of the world, into DC, right? He'll lead you right into the middle of the people. But what Abraham builds is not a tower for his glory, but he builds an altar for God's. And he stacks up some simple rocks and he kneels and says, I'm yours. Right? And what I love about that is one goes east, one goes west. One builds a tower, the other builds an altar. One, his name's a joke. I heard you all giggle whenever I said the word Nimrod. The other changed the whole world. Because Abram trusted God and God gave him a kid, Isaac. Isaac had a son, Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. Out of the nation of Israel rose Judah. Judah, God said, kings are gonna come from you, Judah. One of them, the scepter will never depart from him, and he will roar and gather his people. He will be the lion of Judah. And out of Abraham came Jesus. That's the line you follow through the rest of your Bible. Galatians 3:16 says the promise was spoken to Abraham and to his seed. And he doesn't say seeds referring to many, but to your seed, that is Christ. Abraham was in the lineage of bringing Jesus onto the planet. And we get invited into that story. Galatians 3 says, Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Therefore, be sure that those of you who are of faith are the sons of Abraham. The scripture foreseeing that God would justify the ethnos, the nations, by faith, preached the gospel beforehand to Abram, saying all the nations will be blessed in you. So then those who are of faith are blessed with Abraham, the believer. If you've heard the name Jesus, if you've put your faith in him, if you believe him, you can thank Father Abraham because he had many sons. Many sons had Father Abraham. I'm one of them, and so are you. So let's just praise the Lord. Well, not yet, but you know, you get the idea. Now, am I telling you to quit your job? No. Am I telling you to get off social media? No. But I am asking you to check your heart. Are you building a tower for your glory? Are you building an altar for his? Are you going east, compromising decisions and how you treat people, how you talk to people, because you're just after yours? What are you gonna build at the end, and is that even what you want? Are you saying, I'm gonna walk by faith with the Lord, and I'm gonna walk the way he says to walk. I'm gonna love even my enemies, which sounds crazy. I'm gonna obey even when it's hard. I'm gonna honor him with my mouth, with my body, with my money, with my language, with my life. I'm gonna honor him. And even though there will be people in the world that says, you're crazy, that craziness will make me stand out. And maybe rather than just tucking in with the culture, I'll change it. That's what happens. God leads his people. All Martin Luther wanted to do was have a scholarly discussion on indulgences. And God says, no, I want you to lead a revival, sir. You walk with me. All Billy Graham wanted to do was join the military. He just couldn't do it. He's a little guy, so he ate a lot. Finally got a shot at it and got sick. And God crushed his dreams. Why? Because God said, I want you to just talk about me. And Billy Graham counseled, 10 presidents, preach the gospel to more people in the world? I'd say he got an upgrade. Moses wanted to be left alone with the sheep. God says, no, I want you to shepherd a nation. I wanted to be a success at football. No one had the heart to tell me that at 135 pounds, 5'9", there wasn't a long future down that road. I was just doing it to get the approval of my dad. God took it away. But I remember as I laid on that bed doing recovery on my knee, it was like 2 years later, they came up with this machine that like broke the scar tissue for you. I didn't get that machine. So what I had to do when they took my cast off was break the scar tissue so my knee would someday work again. So while all my friends went and played in football, I would sit in the trainer's office and just go, yeah, why God, right? And just that sort of thing. And then I remember a Bible study leader came into my house, I basically lived there, came into the trainer's office, and he said, hey Ben, I got a chance to lead this event with freshman football players. Freshman football practice gets out earlier than upperclassmen football practice. I got a chance to lead a rally with them where McDonald's has worked a deal. I get fries, a drink, and a Coke for like $2, and I'm gonna feed them all and then share with them the message of Jesus. And I thought, I really want some older football players to help me do it. He says, but none of them can because they're out playing football. And then I remembered you, and you broke your leg, and you can't play football anymore, and you're just laying here. And I'm like, all these things are true. And he's like, can you help me? And I said, sure. I was like, I don't know how I'm gonna hand out hamburgers with crutches, but whatever. So I show up, entire freshman football team there, and I roll in and we're handing out hamburgers and drinks and fries. And I remember I look over him at one point, I'm like, at some point he's gotta do something. And I remember he looked at me and he goes, well, say something. I was like, what? And he's like, someone's gotta tell him about Jesus, go man. And then he walked off and I was like, wait, what? And for the first time in my life, I stood up in front of these kids and just told them, you're beautiful in the image of God. Like you, every single person has dignity because you were made by him. The master's hands have touched you. Every human being has dignity because God made you, but every human being is broken because of sin, and we can't fix us, and we have wandered down many paths and built many little idols to ourselves. None of us are what we're meant to be, but God in his mercy sent a hero, Jesus, to be the perfect person we could not. The hero came racing down the corridors of time through Abraham to get to us, to live the perfect life we couldn't, die the death we deserved, beat death, crushing our fear of death, giving us eternal significance by saying, heaven smiles on you, God loves you, the Father sees you, heaven loves you so much that God sent his son that you might live through him, that whoever believes in him wouldn't perish but have life. You may not get the applause of the crowd, but heaven rejoices when you come to faith in Jesus. I just got to preach that simple message for the first time. And I remember at the end of it, it was one of those ministries where you give up cards, people evaluate at the end. And he came up to me afterwards and was like, hey, you should have these cards. And he handed me two stacks of cards. And one of them was a stack of kit from a young man that said, hey, I want to know more about this Jesus you're talking about. And the other stack was people that said, I want in. If Jesus is coming to save, save me. If he's coming to heal broken things, I'm broken. If he's coming to lead me by faith rather than fear, if he's leading me to walk with him and be known and loved already up front before I've done a thing and then liberated to do things, not for my glory, but for their good, I'm in. I'm done building towers for me. I want to build an altar to him. I'm done chasing my glory. I want to be a blessing to others. Bless me, God, so I can bless this community. I'm ready to use my gifts, my power, my energy for the sake of others, not just me, because there's no satisfaction in this direction. There's all kinds in radical self-donation. You will never find satisfaction in self-absorption. You will find it in radical self-donation. You will. And I had a group of guys that said, I want that. And I remember looking at those cards and looking at my leg and saying, man, I wanted that, but this is better. This is better. Now, I'm not saying God's gonna take your dreams away. Some of you are gonna be the next president of the United States, whatever your dream is, or the next whatever, and it's gonna be amazing. I just hope when you're there, you know that who you are in Christ. So when you're blessed, you use it to be a blessing. When you've been given much, you give much, right? But where does it start? Not by us trying to build for our own glory, but us resting in a God who wants to carry us home. Where it starts is faith, not fear, but faith. I trust you, God, with my life. I'm going on a walk with you. Let me pray for us.
If
If you were encouraged by today's talk and believe it would be uplifting to others, then be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcasts. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thanks for listening to the Passion City Church podcast.